This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 31st of August 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One in London with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up over the next 60 minutes, a new report by the IAEA reveals that Iran's nuclear program has not been slowed by economic sanctions. In a moment, we'll be talking to our regular contributor, Daniela Peled, and we'll be finding out why tourism numbers are spiking in Venezuela.
I think the second great heritage that Venezuela has after oil is its touristic potential. It's a country that has an infinite number of opportunities for tourism. There are few countries that offer so many different things.
And we'll also be talking to an independent graphic publisher in Marylebone for a weekly Meet the Neighbour segment.
My passion for graphic novels started from a personal interest in manga and Japanese comics, and then grew from there into sort of more independent graphic novels, things like V for Vendetta and other kind of British kind of comic scene and stuff like that.
And as it's a Friday afternoon, we thought we would look back on the last 5 days in news, maybe the last seven if we want to. We have both our editor, Andrew Tuck, and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, are going to be with us, and they're actually in the studio right now. Steve, what stands out for you?
We've got to talk about Tampa, really, haven't we? The Republican convention. That's been the big story of the week.
Andrew, where do you feel?
I think we're going to be looking at what's been happening in Tehran. Is it the meeting place for the independent world?
Nothing about the lion that was or wasn't in Essex?
We can talk about that lion as well, because I've got a few theories.
We also might have a few songs too, right here on Midori House, live on Monocle 24. And welcome to Studio One here at Midori House on a Friday evening, just 2 minutes after 1800 here in London, which means it's news time with Jonathan Wheatley.
Fifteen years after the car crash that killed Diana, Princess of Wales, a small crowd of people have gathered today at a makeshift memorial next to Paris's Alma Bridge, just feet away from the concrete column where the princess and her partner Dodi Al-Fayed were killed while being followed by news photographers on the night of the 31st of August 1997. Here is what some tourists in Paris were saying about her.
Because she's a legacy and she really, you know, had impacted so many people's lives, she changed a lot of people's lives. You know, and she still lives on today. You know.
I think they'll still be coming in 5, 10, 15 years or more. You know, so that I was so besotted by her sort of thing. She's so lovely that they'll keep coming. You know, and I think we'll be back.
People on Japan's southern island of Ishigaki are preparing for a possible tsunami later on tonight after a 7.6 magnitude quake struck off the coast of the Philippines. Japan's Coast Guard scrambled vessels out of port, both to prevent them from being caught by any possible waves and also to warn vessels around the harbour. The African Union has held a memorial service today in Addis Ababa for the late Ethiopian Prime Minister Meles Zenawi, who died on the 21st of August in Brussels, where he was being treated for an unspecified ailment. The Speaker of the Ethiopian Parliament, Obu Barbada Gamada, said that his country's former Prime Minister was good at articulating Africa's interests on the international stage.
The late Prime Minister Meles had indeed played a significant role in the advancement of the cardinal objective for our continental organization. Particularly, he gives intellectual guidance and strategic leadership in pushing forward African development agenda.
Mohamed Nasheed, the former president of the Maldives, insists he was removed from his post illegitimately and says he will fight to get his job back, as hundreds of his supporters took to the streets to back him and protest a report concluding he had been legally replaced. Here's what he said this afternoon in the capital, Male.
We will go to the elections whenever it is held. We still believe, we hope that elections would be held early. And we will go to the elections with a program to the people, as we have done in the past. And we believe we would win that election on a first round very handsomely. We have no doubt about that.
Mitt Romney has formally accepted the Republican Party's presidential nomination. He told the National Convention in Tampa in Florida that President Obama had failed to deliver on promises of hope and change. Well, the actor Clint Eastwood agreed with Romney and delighted fellow Republicans there by mocking the current president.
I never thought that it was a good idea for attorneys to be president anyway. There are always devils advocating this. and bifurcating this and bifurcating that, you know, all that stuff. But I think it's maybe time, what do you think, for maybe a businessman? How
about that? Meanwhile, President Barack Obama has announced that he will visit Louisiana on Monday to meet officials in the state dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Isaac. Obama will survey the damage from the hurricane and make sure that needs are being met. And finally, a British skydiver whose parachute failed to open during a jump in New Zealand said he was sitting there dying afterwards but is now recovering in hospital. Liam Dunn broke his back and said he ought to be dead after crashing to the ground at high speed. He miraculously survived a 13,000-foot fall by landing in a bog. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. You managed to find the best Clint Eastwood clip because the rest of it was rather cringy.
He garbles a bit, and I think he's getting on a bit now, isn't he?
It was not a great PR moment or stage managing moment for the Republican Party. We're going to be talking about that a little bit later with Andrew Tucker, editor, foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18:06 in London. We are going to go away for a short break. We're back in a moment.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Dobropa Jalavert, Monocle 24.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, this.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, new reports by the IAEA reveal that the Iranian nuclear program has not been slowed by economic sanctions. The country has installed more than 2,100 centrifuges inside an underground laboratory, and it has boosted production of nuclear fuel. Well, how will Israel react to these reports, and what are the next steps for the international community? Well, in the studio now, I'm joined by Daniela Peled, someone who I've spent a lot of time in the studio before you went off for a short break. And I'm also joined on the line by Scott Lucas, who's at the University of Birmingham and is the editor of the foreign affairs blog EA Worldview. Daniela, I'll start with you. I mean, if we take it from the Israeli perspective, probably not exactly news, any of this, to anyone who's sitting in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem.
No, not news at all. I mean, for all the actors, the IAEA report was expected. But it comes at a very crucial time, ahead of the American elections. And the next 6 weeks, really, if there isn't a strike then I think we can expect a hiatus until the spring for a number of reasons, both political and, frankly, meteorological, because an Israeli air force are going to be very, very unsure about any kind of strike of no later than mid-October.
I mean, it was actually throughout the winter period. I remember, you know, actually doing, you know, a number of interviews. You know, we were talking to various experts, in Israel about, you know, a number of exercise sorties that were taking place. A lot of reports about not necessarily stockpiling of gas masks, et cetera, but some civil defense mobilization, et cetera. Any word that's occurring again?
Yeah, that's been stepped up as well. Also, there's in October, there's going to be a very large joint military maneuver with the Americans, and staff are already arriving, which is another reason why you could argue that this would not be an opportune time for there to be an attack.
I wanted to ask you, Scott, oftentimes when we see major exercises, joint or otherwise, they've also been, in a way, sort of, set dressing, a bit of saber rattling at the same time, because, once you have a deployment in the region, well, once the exercise is over, they might stick around, and why not use them?
Well, at this point, I would suggest that both the presentation of the IAEA report and the Israeli exercise are more posture than substance. I say that about the report because, in fact, we haven't seen it yet. It's restricted. It's not supposed to be seen. Usually it's leaked, either just before or just after the spin goes to the press. And in this case, the spin basically is that while Iran has doubled the centrifuges at its second nuclear plant at Fordow, they are not operational. In other words, Iran is no closer to a military nuclear capability, even if it was pursuing it. Now, as for the Israelis, I differ from a lot of people on this, but I maintain that the main aim of most of the Israeli chatter is to maintain pressure on Iran. In other words, by threatening the possibility of an attack, they keep the Americans pushing up economic sanctions and pushing up political pressure on Iran. And they also use it to divert attention from other issues, because for many months, the Iran threat has been really been used by Israeli politicians to divert attention, say, for example, from the issue closer to home of how you deal with Palestine, and also with the very tricky issue for the Israeli leadership of how they deal with changes in the Arab world.
Do you think, though, if you're sitting in Tehran right now, you've just had, you know, quite a large mobilization of international leadership at the summit of non-aligned nations, and you know, you've had the Secretary General show up. You have, you know, India at the top table. Of course, you have President Morsi, you know, forcing the Syrians to storm out. But nevertheless, I mean, do you feel slightly, you know, emboldened if you're Iran just by, you know, staging, you know, which became, you know, quite a high profile, you know, international summit?
Well, actually, the Israeli threat is a get-out-of-jail card for the Iranians because they've had a terrible week with the non-aligned summit. They thought it was going to be this major PR, you know, victory, and that they had all these leaders showing up. But in fact, they got publicly slapped down by the United Nations Secretary General over Israel, over human rights, over the nuclear issue, and they were humiliated by the Egyptian president, who they thought would support them, but who basically said that it was time for the Iranians to back off support for President Assad. That was a major, major setback for the Iranians. What they can do, though, however, is try to play that down and go back to their public and say, well, the enemies are still trying to come after us. Israel's still the main threat. Indeed, that's exactly what the Supreme Leader has done today.
I mean, that's the point, because a lot of what was said, I mean, even you know, Mr. Morsi's comments, also Ban Ki-moon as well, you know, was not translated to the wider Iranian populace. So I guess, you know, if you're the Iranian leadership, are you know, as long as it plays well at home, do you think that almost does half the battle for them?
Well, Khamenei's speech is one that would have been heard by the Iranian public, and he was very clear in saying both his usual message that they've no intention of developing nuclear arms, but have every right to continue with their nuclear program, and also that Israel was a threat to Iran and had to be demolished, had to be seen off. I mean, he has huge support when it comes to that, but I do think it takes a little bit more than Israel and America as you know, these sort of dark figures threatening Iran to rally support. It has been a very bad week.
I mean, Danny, we've even seen a mobilization of journalists as well in Israel right now. It almost, you know, sometimes when you see some of the major networks showing up and things like that, not that they're necessarily having you know, preferential access to you know, intelligence cables and what they, you know, they might be planning in the Israeli Ministry of Defense. I mean, how likely, you know, looking at election in November and things like that, you know, if you're looking at cables going between Israel and the U.S. right now, how much is the U.S. Leaning on Israel to say, let's keep a lid on it, let cooler heads prevail for right now, for all of the obvious reasons?
Well, relations between the White House and Israel have not been good, should we say, during Obama's term, and they've been deteriorating recently as well. The dispute is not, as we all know, whether, you know, America is not in favour of Iran developing nuclear weapons, but the question is, they're very firm that we have not yet reached the point of no return, not crossed the red line. Whereas Israel, or rather Netanyahu and his defence minister, Ehud Barak, are convinced that really the time is now and there's no time to be lost. But in this, they don't have support necessarily from the Israeli public, and the cabinet is split. The military is dubious about the right time to attack. So I think they have those forces to deal with domestically, and what the Americans say is making not that much of an impact at the moment.
I mean, Scott, oftentimes leadership will look for tidy solutions, and there's certainly no neat solution to Syria at the moment. And, you know, any type of strike, no matter how well planned and executed, you know, is still going to be a huge risk, even to the Israeli Air Force. But could it be argued, though, that something has to be almost done in Iran if someone's also going to, you know, manage to, and if we're going to look at, you know, eventual intervention in Syria, that it almost has to come as something of a package deal?
Well, I think if Netanyahu and Barak are dedicated to a strike on Iran, I think they're misguided for a number of reasons. I think there are serious issues about whether a strike would be effective. I think, however, there's an even greater issue, and that is if the Israelis strike Iran, it's not just a question of Iran trying to strike back at Israel, you know, with Israelis mobilizing and wearing gas masks. The fact of the matter is that most of the Arab world will rise up against Israel, not necessarily with direct attacks, although don't rule that out from, say, someone like Hezbollah, but politically they'll rise up against Israel. And that's what the Americans are telling them. There was a stand-up fight, apparently, in diplomatic terms, between the American ambassador and Benjamin Netanyahu this week, when Netanyahu criticized Obama, and the ambassador said, quite frankly, Obama was defending Israeli interest. And the U.S. chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, who was actually speaking to the Israeli military as much as to Netanyahu, basically said, don't attack. The political cost in the Middle East, beyond Iran, are too high for you to carry out such an irresponsible operation. Mm.
Danielle, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And as I said, Netanyahu and Barak increasingly seem to be out on a limb with this. There's great popular support for action on Iran, but this kind of attack, that no one has any illusion that it will do anything more than set back the program by a year.
Mm.
So really, is it worth the retaliation? Which, absolutely right, all kinds of proxies, Hezbollah and so on, although they have their own issues to deal with at the moment, are likely to launch attacks not just on Israel, but also on Jewish targets abroad. I mean, the consequences are going to be massive. But I think this has been a project of Netanyahu for a very, very long time. I don't think that sort of rationale is going to be enough to push him away from an attack. And the military will have to go along with what the cabinet agrees.
Absolutely. Danielle Lepeled, regular contributor here at Monocle, and Scott Lucas at the University of Birmingham, editor of the foreign affairs blog EA Worldview. Thanks very much. You are listening to Midori House, 16 minutes past 1800 here in London. We're back after this.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Welcome back to Midori House, where I am joined by our editor Andrew Tuck and our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. Is this something of a new segment? We've always talked about doing a week in review. Friday afternoon in London, the end of what was a remarkably good production week, don't you think?
It was a very good production.
We were panicked last week because we thought we had a bank holiday in the UK. We don't really pay attention too much to the onset of Labor Day, but we thought there was going to be a bit of a hiccup. But we were feeling reasonably confident last Friday afternoon, weren't we?
Yeah, and I think it's also because you and me came in on that bank holiday and we actually got the
cover. We were in for 3 days.
We got the cover out of the way, which is a rare thing. We did that early.
Did you know, actually, I changed the mask. It says martyrs. No.
I didn't mind coming on the odd hour or two of the bank holiday. But what was good was, I don't know, yeah, somehow we managed to get the whole thing out. But it's got a bit of an interesting theme. We're going to be looking at the Portuguese world next issue. And, yeah, I think we went to some surprising places. And
You didn't go anywhere, really, did you?
Well, I went down to the Portuguese deli around the corner to get some lunch.
But Steve, you managed a trip to Lisbon.
I did indeed, yes. I sent people to more exciting places,
yes, you did.
To Maputo and Azores. But I went myself to Lisbon, which is an amazing city, and had a really great time, and did some work as well.
And some work as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's look back over the last seven, or if we want, five days, gentlemen. And Steve, I'll start with you. At the top of the show, you mentioned Tampa being both... wasn't quite the epicenter of a tropical storm that probably most news networks wanted, but it was certainly, of course, and has been the home of the Republicans now for the last few days.
It certainly has, and they had a difficult task, the Republicans, with this convention, because firstly there was the Hurricane Isaac, then Tropical Storm Isaac, which, even if it wasn't going to hit Tampa, was certainly going to take away a lot of their news coverage in the US. Then they had the problem that the Democrats are going to start their convention straight after, so you don't get much of a proper bounce. And then their big problem is that Mitt Romney is a little bit boring and no one really knows what he's like. And all week they were talking about, oh, we're going to humanize Mitt. Now, the problem when you start saying we need to humanize Mitt, it's already gone too far. And it's quite hard to turn that around and say, oh, well, you know, actually in private, he's a lovely man. And, you know, I used to bake him tuna casserole and he's just like you and me. You know, he's not. He's not like you and me. Mm. And we know that. And I think they had a bit of difficulty dealing with that.
Andrew, when you look back to last night and seeing Mitt on stage and in Jumbotron format behind the podium, and that rather completely bizarre walk-on and dialogue between Clint Eastwood and an imaginary Obama, how did the whole thing strike you?
Well, I think they must have kind of been ruining the moment they decided to have on Clint, because it was embarrassing and it was awkward and terrible. But the Romney speech was interesting, I think, because he was trying to do so many things in such a short space of time. He was trying to play himself, obviously, to his, you know, his faithful and to the people in the audience. But there's always a risk when you cheer, you know, your audience are cheering, but actually beyond the convention centre, the people who are the more floating voters just don't get what you're on about. And he did try to nuance it a little bit, but it was just like this terrible checklist you had a sense of him going through. And, you know, women, I like women. Mm. That was, you know, it was okay, there isn't a great deal you've got to say about this. And I just thought some of it was for a European audience, especially. Of course, he's not appealing to us, but it just played so strangely. The jokes about, you know, Obama being caring about, you know, global warming, and the idea that should never be an idea that a president would ever get involved in. It just seems so strange when actually in Europe we're, you know, recycling like crazy. We are concerned about those things. You just felt that it was almost another world that he was describing.
Well, it was incredibly simplistic. It just, you know, Putin, and then all of a sudden, you know, Mitt throws out two lines, and then the audience is booing as well. And I thought that was one of the very strange things, that there was this applause, and then just booing no matter what just seemed very negative, I think, in the context of a Republican convention, you know, even if you do want to slight the president.
There were a couple of things very striking, actually, I felt, about both the speech and the way that Romney has been presented this week, which made me think of two very unpopular British politicians, Gordon Brown, former British Prime Minister, and Ian Duncan Smith, who was a Tory party leader about 10 years ago. Now, Ian Duncan Smith was not loved by his party, but obviously they want him to win. And right before one election, he made a speech at party conference and got 18 standing ovations. And it all looked inside the hall. It's like, wow, he's really popular. It's great. He resigned within a few weeks because actually no one liked him. And there was something of that they were getting excited about Mitt, but they're not really excited about Mitt. And just like with Gordon Brown, you've had lots of people saying, oh, you know, if you actually get to know Mitt, he's a really nice guy, which is what they said about Gordon Brown as well. And, you know, that didn't really help.
I want to come back to British politics in a second, but for those who might have missed Mitt on stage, here's just a little clip from last night.
To the majority of Americans who now believe that the future will not be better than the past, I can guarantee you this. If Barack Obama is reelected, you'll be right. I wish President Obama had succeeded because I want America to succeed.
A little bit rich and presumptuous, Andrew. What do you...
It's just so funny, as Steve was saying. It just plays so awkwardly beyond that conference center, and yeah, presumptuous. And the way he describes Obama is really peculiar as well. But I think that what's odd is also just the vox pops you've seen with people who are there. This phrase that comes up again and again: "I want my country back." And I think there's a real sense that, you know, a racial divide. You look around that audience; it's a white audience. Mm. There's a real sense, you know. There's a racial undertone in what they're saying about Obama, but for the Republicans, there's this terrible demographic, you know, time bomb in front of them. The fact that America is becoming more Hispanic, more racially mixed, and they can't play that game. There's a limit to how long it will work.
Absolutely. Sorry,
and that's interesting, I think, in Romney's speech, why he was trying to say things. It was sort of more in sorrow than in anger. I wanted Obama to succeed, and I know people wanted hope and change, because I think he and his advisors are aware that they can't just be the angry people on the outside going, oh, I don't like this, this is all wrong. That they kind of need to appeal to the rest of America, that many people think, well, you know, even if I don't like Obama's policies, he seems like a nice guy, and, you know, I think he's probably doing his best. And that's a tricky thing to play against.
And maybe we should cue Ann Romney.
No one
one will care more. And no one will move heaven and earth like Mitt Romney to make this country a better place to live.
We need a fanfare like that. That sense of validation, so much weight put on this poor woman's shoulders as well. When you talked about, you know, the humanization of the man, but again, you know, it was also incredibly stage managed and just came across, I thought, as incredibly hollow.
And I think even if people go, "Oh, Ann Romney, she seems nice," doesn't mean I'm going to vote for Mitt.
No,
you know, it needs far more than that. And I think you may. I mean, it's still 2-3 months to go, but I really can't see, unless something disastrous happens, I really can't see how Romney can turn this around.
No, absolutely. Sorry, Andrew, go
ahead. I was just going to say, you shouldn't concentrate on these things too much, but there was something quite interesting about even the choice of dress, that red dress. It wasn't a dress, it wasn't a business dress, it wasn't a kind of a woman going to work. There was something almost 50s about it, something a little bit kind of Mad Men. It kind of threw back to a time.
It could have been from the Banana Republic Mad Men collection.
Yes.
It wouldn't surprise you.
And that I think they were trying to say, look, you know, she's colourful, she looks amazing, but actually she's behind her husband. There was something very conservative about the way that whole look of hers was put together.
Now, before we went on air, we said that we probably weren't going to devote the whole time to the Republicans in Tampa. We've almost managed to do that. So let's just touch on British politics very quickly. We were going to try to get to Toronto. It's not going to happen. In the UK this week, so much news about Heathrow. We have, you know, someone, a backbencher in the Tory party who has really come out and you know, demanded whether RPM is a man or a mouse, that he should really sort of stand up for Heathrow Airport or not. And of course, a raging debate at a time when people want to see, you know, big infrastructure projects. We managed to get through the Olympics, just fine. I think, you know, much to the surprise and delight of people in this country and elsewhere in the world. But it's interesting how Heathrow really erupted into quite a big story. It's actually had quite a good summer, all in. And I want to know from both of you, do you think that, you know, the fact that you've got a Tory backbench, sure, you know, slightly ganging up, you've got Cameron not quite coming, he's got a spokesperson saying, you know, we don't want to wade into this debate. You've got, the other side of the coalition, Clegg saying, you know, absolutely not, we're not going to be adding a third runway to the airport. Does this become a bigger issue by the time everyone gets back to work in the next 2 weeks in this country?
I think he's played it so badly. He's kind of guaranteed that he will not support this additional runway. And now he can't do anything until there's another election without looking like a fool or a liar. He's lost the kind of... There was a little bit of consensus for something to happen some months ago, which he's also lost. And the funny thing I always think that's lost in this debate is that actually everyone's always worried about the people who live around the airport. Now, of course, it's not great having huge planes flying over your house. But actually, the reason all those people are around the airport is
because they work there.
It's because they work there, exactly.
Or they use it a lot.
Yeah, well, but it's hundreds of people who work in all the services there.
Absolutely, Steve.
They have a very real problem. To put it in some context, when David Cameron was running for Tory leader, he wanted to make out he was new, he was different. And so he latched onto the green agenda as this was his thing. You know, I'll put a windmill on my house, I'll be against a third runway, I'll go up to Greenland and, you know, have a photo of me with some huskies. So when it came to the election, he was very adamant, I'm not going to do this. They've clearly come into office and then realised, oh, actually, I think we do need to do this. And they don't know how to get out of it. And my favourite thing about it is that he's appointed as his transport secretary a woman who campaigned against the third runway in her constituency. And her constituency is Putney. She can't support it.
She's got 747-400s flying over her constituency all day.
Yeah, and they obviously just haven't thought about it at all.
She also has Greener last name as well.
Yeah, that doesn't help either.
No. Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Andrew Tuck, our editor, have a fantastic weekend. You're off to Berlin. People will probably be hearing from you in Napoli next week, I believe.
Yes, I'm going to be at the UN Habitat Conference Monday to Wednesday next week.
Yeah, but you have a very nice time also on the Mediterranean. I'll just have to stick that in. And Steve Bloomfield, our foreign editor, have a fantastic weekend.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midori House. We're back right after this.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать в Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And we're almost at the bottom of the hour here on Midori House. In the next half hour of the program, we hear how Bollywood films are trying to make it in Brazil, and we'll also be heading north to Venezuela to find out how the country is trying to increase its tourism figures. But first, Here's Jonathan Wheatley with the bottom of our headlines.
Thanks very much, Tara. 15 years after the car crash that killed Diana, Princess of Wales, a small crowd of people have gathered today at a makeshift memorial next to Paris's Alma Bridge, just feet away from the concrete column where the princess and her partner Dodi Al-Fayed were killed while being followed by news photographers on the same night of the 31st of August 1997. People in Japan's southern island of Ishigaki are preparing for a possible tsunami later on tonight after a 7.6 magnitude quake struck the coast of the Philippines. Japan's Coast Guard has scrambled vessels out of port, both to prevent them from being caught by any possible waves and also to warn vessels around the harbour. The African Union has held a memorial service today in the capital of Ethiopia, Addis Ababa, for the late Prime Minister there, Meles Zenawi, who died on the 21st of August in Brussels, where he was being treated for an unspecified ailment. Mohamed Nasheed, the former president of the Maldives, insists he was removed from his post illegitimately and says he will fight to get his job back as hundreds of his supporters took to the streets to back him and to protest a report concluding he had been legally replaced. Mitt Romney has formally accepted the Republican Party's presidential nomination. He told the National Convention in Tampa, in Florida, that President Obama had failed to deliver on promises of hope and change. Well, President Barack Obama has announced that he will visit Louisiana on Monday to meet officials in the state dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Isaac. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Mr. Wheatley. You are listening to Midori House. It's just 18:31 here in London. Well, Venezuela has the longest Caribbean coastline of any country, the world's highest waterfall, as well as tropical plains and snow-capped Andean mountains. But its tourism figures are poor and nowhere near as high as neighboring Colombia, which is still struggling with an active rebel group. Venezuela's annual tourism fair begins next Thursday, the 6th of September, and the country will be making a special effort to attract the attention this year, backed by the United Nations World Tourism Organization. Well, for more on that, our correspondent in Caracas, Sarah Granger, has more.
Okay, so this is kind of like the financial district of Caracas. We are in the borderline of between Chacao.
Fresh off the plane and just a couple of days into a 10-day visit to Venezuela, a tour group of Americans and Canadians are seeing the sights of Caracas. But these are no ordinary tourists. They've little interest in visiting the natural wonders and beautiful beaches that Venezuela has to offer. So why did they come?
It's mostly because I have kind of a love affair with Cuba. I've been to Cuba 5 times since 2006, and I really wanted to better understand the connection between the two countries.
I have very specific reasons why I'm on this trip, and it's definitely not for tourism. The reason I chose to come here was because I've been a political activist pretty much my entire life.
I'm doing a master's program in school, and my thesis is on Venezuela, which is about the Venezuelan feminist movement and how it's been operating under Hugo Chavez the last 14 years. So I came to do sort of an observational research, see what the reality is here versus what we read in the media and what I've been reading.
These ladies have all signed up to a reality tour of Venezuela, run by a human rights organization based in San Francisco. The principal attraction is Venezuela's political system and its biggest star, Hugo Chavez. But while almost 14 years of socialism may be of interest to some, generally speaking, few international travelers choose Venezuela as a destination. The government has blamed poor visitor numbers on the country's negative image in the international press. Alejandro Fleming is the Minister for Tourism.
There's an international network that says Venezuela is an insecure country, unstable and dangerous, that the revolution and President Chavez keep coming, and that the revolutionaries eat people. The revolution should dismantle and knock down this media network.
It's true that Venezuela does have a reputation for insecurity, but that doesn't mean it can't attract tourists. The World Bank estimates just over 600,000 international tourists visited in 2009. Neighbouring Colombia, a similar size to Venezuela and with similar attributes, received more than 2 million.
Bienvenuti. Welcome.
Welcome. Bem-vindo.
Welcome. Bienvenidos.
Welcome to a country where the loveliest beaches fuse with snow-capped mountains.
Colombia has had huge success with its publicity campaign, which made a virtue out of the country's recent history of drug trafficking and leftist rebels.
The only risk is wanting to stay.
Could Venezuela do the same?
Buenos días, tengo una cita con el señor Coimbra.
I went to meet Bobby Coimbra, president of the Andean office of the ad agency Ogilvy & Mather.
Definitely, yes. I think the second great heritage that Venezuela has after oil is its touristic potential. It's a country that has an infinite number of opportunities for tourism. There are few countries that offer so many different things. Here there's desert, mountains, Amazon jungle, beaches. It's very difficult to find that elsewhere, and everything here is very close together.
A Brazilian who's lived in Venezuela for 20 years, Mr. Coimbra says tourism has never been the country's strong suit.
This isn't a characteristic of the current government. Since I arrived 20 years ago, I've never seen any government bothered about tourism, and no government has ever had a plan to effectively develop the sector and sell Venezuela as a tourist destination. The big problem for Venezuela is that it has a lot of oil, honestly, and that means the country doesn't worry about making other plans.
Success in marketing Venezuela isn't unprecedented. Julio Arnaldez is the president of the country's Tourism Council.
About 15 years ago, there was a slogan, Venezuela, the best-kept secret of the Caribbean. And it made Venezuela, and particularly the island of Margarita, competitive with the rest of the Caribbean islands. It was very successful, but since then, the ministry has changed slogans, image, concepts, and markets constantly. There have been a series of changes that basically have just generated distortion and confusion in the international market.
It's not all doom and gloom. International hotel chain Intercontinental recently opened a brand new property in Venezuela's second city of Maracaibo. Jorge Landa is the area manager.
We are more on a longer term, and we foresee great demand here in this city, a great, you know, economic future for the city, and so we absolutely feel this is the right decision. And in Venezuela, this country has, you know, it's an amazing country because it's so rich, and the people also, you know, they have a spirit of optimism. You know, we are definitely betting on Venezuela.
Venezuela remains something of a secret as the country's tourism authorities grapple with how to market the destination. But there's a good incentive to succeed. Venezuela is blessed with many of the ingredients essential for a lucrative tourism industry. For Monocle in Caracas, I'm Sarah Granger.
And you are listening to Midori House. It is just 2038 now in Istanbul, 1838 here in London. And if you're listening in Caracas, it's 1308. Midori House is back right after this.
Monocle 24 is growing. We're proud to introduce The Stack, a new program on air every Saturday. This lively one-hour show is a celebration of print media, exploring the best in periodicals, niche journals, and newspapers, and talking to the people from around the world who are pushing the sector forward and shaping the media landscape. Scheduled to run on Saturdays at 10 a.m. UK time and repeated on Sundays, the show will be an intimate conversation around a coffee table stacked with interesting magazines and newspapers from around the globe, hosted by Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. That's The Stack, every Saturday morning at 10 a.m. UK time, repeated on Sundays and available online. Brought to you in association with J.Crew.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cozy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
survey of the global newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
And welcome back to Midori House. This is Desafinado. It's actually, well, it's Brazilian in spirit, but it's performed by Lovisa, who is a Swedish artist, but is doing a little bit of a Nordic rendition on Bossa Nova.
Join with me in harmony and sing a song of loving. We've got to get in tune again before too long. There'll be no desafinado when your heart belongs to me completely. Then you won't be slightly out of tune. You'll sing along with me.
And that was Lovisa, Swedish artist, with Desafinado. You are listening to Midori House. It's just 14 minutes to the top of the hour here in London. Going away for a short break. We're back right after this.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Dette Monaco 24.
Esse Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
En Monaco 24 laget, ja.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 i Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The Broca Jalava.
Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé. Well, every Friday here on the program, we go and meet the neighbors around our office in Marylebone. This week, we head to the Bureau of Self-Made Hero Publisher, an independent graphic novel publisher launched in 2007. We sent along our Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who checked in with the marketing director, Doug Wallace, earlier today.
I'm Doug Wallace, Marketing Director for Self-Made Hero, a graphic novel publisher based in Marylebone. My passion for graphic novels started from a personal interest in manga and Japanese comics, and then grew from there into sort of more independent graphic novels, things like V for Vendetta and other kind of British kind of comic scene and stuff like that. I didn't grow up reading sort of 2000 AD and those kind of slightly more fantasy things, but I did, as a sort of a kid, read kind of the Beano and the Dandy and things like that. And I think it just sort of stayed with me. Self-Made Hero is a graphic novel publisher, which was set up in 2007 by Emma Haley. And I joined Self-Made Hero that year to help launch the house. And my role here is marketing director. I look after all the press and the marketing and also the foreign acquisitions. So when we take graphic novels from other leading publishers in Europe and languages other than English, I help select them and then get them published here and promote them and bring authors over and get them known by British readers. We've just launched in America, so we're now a British and American publisher of graphic novels. So we're, as far as I know, the only British publisher with a US list of graphic novels, and we only publish graphic novels. So that's one of our major projects for sort of this year, and establishing ourselves over there in the States, which is a quite unique thing. And our latest project would be, the big project for autumn is The Now of Brown. The Now of Brown is a debut graphic novel by a British creator called Glyn Dillon. And it's a wonderful story about a half Japanese, half English girl who has OCD, a particular form of OCD, which is called Pure O, which means that she has violent, morbid thoughts that sort of take up her mind, and she has to try and calm herself down. So it's a story of her sort of struggle to deal with this as she works in a designer vinyl toy shop in London. My favorite thing about Marylebone is probably Daunt's Books. I mean, the massive travel section, you can just go in there and pick up anything you want, and I've got a bit of a fetish for hardback books, so I can't think of anywhere better to go and get them.
And that was Midori House Neighbor Self-Made Hero Publishers. That was Doug Wallace, their marketing director, talking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And we'll keep it in the neighborhood in very close proximity. We're now just talking about a few desks away From Studio One here at Maduro House, I am joined by our section edits editor, Santiago Tarditi. And in a moment, we'll also be talking to our Marcus Hippie, whose program, The Menu, is coming up in about 9.5 minutes' time. But Santiago, I'll start with you. Friday evening is upon us in London.
Yeah, finally. How are you, Tyler?
I'm very well. I heard the pop of Prosecco bottles outside, so my glass is waiting.
And there's also beer outside.
There's beer as well.
Well, and what's interesting is that beer is going to be the topic today.
Okay.
Because, as you probably have heard, President Obama loves beer.
Mm-hmm.
And he is traveling around the U.S. with his own brew.
Right.
This is a brew called the White House Honey Ale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a type of beer that Obama himself has been brewing since 2011, after he bought a home brewing kit
right.
with his personal fund. What's interesting is that, well, the first time that people actually tasted this beer was during the Super Bowl in 2011. Mm-hmm. 10 gallons of it was made. And right now there is an official Freedom of Information Act
mm-hmm.
That was put forward by small craft brewers and home brewers because they want to know what's in this beer.
Right.
And so far, they need 25,000 signatures in
before
order to
they
make
can
this
ask
happen.
To be released, which of course is all, you know, incredibly good PR at a time, of course, when
exactly,
we, you know, certainly last night after we saw, you know, a couple of jabs by now, you know, Republican leader Mitt Romney, you know, clearly, you know, making some digs at the president, you know, responding pretty much with his back, you know, in various social media channels, you know, to Romney as well. So all of this will, of course, work to sort of serve, you know, a much more cozier image, a more humanized image of the White House. So I'm sure the president's thrilled about that.
I think that will definitely help him connect with the public.
Right.
It happened with Lady Bird Johnson, the wife of President Lyndon B. Johnson, when she shared her recipe for pecan pie, which is nowadays an iconic recipe in American cookbooks.
And of course, we know that there's been so much attention as well, you know, just surrounding Michelle Obama. You know, the Obamas arrive in the White House. One of the first things they do is they, you know, they dig a vegetable garden. The First Lady becomes an enormous champion for healthy eating and is you know, seen in many a photo call in the garden with her children, etc. So anyway, it sort of, you know, I think carries on sort of, you know, the myth and I guess sort of appealing to that sense of sort of craft and family, you know, and even though the Democrats, you know, don't often sort of stand for family values, it's their own interpretation of it.
Well, the honey, now that you say, the honey comes from a beehive in the south lawn in the White House, which
of course it does,
Michelle
Santiago.
Obama takes care of. I don't know if you've seen the bottle of it.
Why
don't
no,
you
I
take a look
it.
In terms of branding? What do you think?
Let's see, the honey. Well, what we have is it's an oval. It's a slightly oval label, which is not unusual on a beer bottle. I'm surprised that they've gone for this burgundy effect. And we have a bumblebee on it. So I mean, the burgundy effect makes me think of wine. The bumblebee makes me think of France and maybe the French court. And I guess, you know, for very obvious reasons, you know, they're not allowed to use the. Well, maybe they could use the presidential seal if they wanted to, but they've chosen not to. I feel it looks rather sort of, you know, Belgian or French.
It does.
Who knows? Maybe this is what they think works, because of course there's lots of very positive associations, you know, with both with Belgian beer and also with French beer as well. But anyway, I think you have to give an assignment to. Our Sasha Eisenberg in Washington to see if he can get his hands on.
I'll ask him to send a couple of bottles and we can try them on Santiago's basket.
Yes, we can. Now, did you bring our Marcus Hippie into studio with you just because, of course, your weekly collaborators on your program and you made a deliberate food appeal because you knew that he was going to be around the microphone? Yes, no?
Of course. That's why I brought him.
Of course.
That voice, huh?
Yeah. Let's not spoil it. We should not say what's going to be in Santiago's basket this this week, but can you give us a little preview, because your program is going on air in exactly 4 minutes and 55 seconds. Well, right after the news, though, but in about 5 minutes, the menu's hitting the airwaves.
Well, we start the program by talking about Spanish cuisine and what is internationally discovered and what actually isn't. We speak to chef, author and broadcaster Spaniard José Pizarro, who's got a restaurant in London, a bar as well. And yeah, his work is to prove to the world that Spanish cuisine is so much more than just tapas and paella.
Right. But do you feel that the rest of the world almost already knows that, or not quite? I mean,
not quite. There are some regions. He argues that in the central Spain, there is a lot that hasn't been discovered.
And I think there has to be a revamp with the tapas. Tapas, I don't know, like currently, I think Portuguese petiscos or Italian cicchetti are kind of shadowing the tapas. So I think it's a good time to revamp that and give it a new flavors, new presentations, make it more exciting, more interesting.
And it's funny because I was in Singapore just last week, and I was talking to, you know, a number of people involved in the tourism business, et cetera, and they were saying that tapas actually had a number of false starts in Southeast Asia, they thought. And now there's a new wave. We went to a fantastic tapas restaurant last week, which was very much of the new generation British chef in the restaurant, and doing something which was very elevated. But I think maybe it was a little bit too pedestrian, a little bit too mass last time, and they felt that's why it's failed. So is that what you mean, maybe that it needs a reinvention, that it hasn't upgraded itself
enough?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I think it's stuck in history, and anything that is pulpo a la gallega, like typical octopus with a bit of paprika, is like the usual thing you eat. But there's so much more to that, and there are a lot of ingredients and flavors and products that really haven't left Spain and been shown to the world. And I think José Pizarro is someone who is doing that, definitely.
I love your Spanish pronunciation, by the way. I was trying to do the same. You do it so much better than
me. Well, I think lots of people also love your Finnicized version of all names Spanish, Marcus. Tell me, what else on the program?
What else? We also hear about the local coffee trends in Jerusalem, and then we head to California, to Livermore Valley. There are very ambitious wine manufacturers in there who are ready to challenge the neighboring Napa Valley and actually the rest of the world with their wines at the same time.
And so the idea of just having greater recognition, I mean, everyone talks about Napa, so they want everyone to be able to talk about Livermore as a valley. Just...
Exactly. And there's actually also one interview from Santiago. Santiago met a chef who's busy training boxing.
Yeah, Andrew McLeish. Uh-huh. He's the chef at Chapter One restaurant.
Right.
Just 25 minutes outside of London. And he's part of a group of chefs that have been training for the past couple of months and will be boxing live at the Royal Automobile Club.
You don't go into the ring with him?
No, I'm very lucky not to, because he's quite a big guy. Yeah, when I interviewed him, just his handshake was scary.
Yeah, but people who haven't seen Santiago in real life, you're also a big guy as well, Santiago. But I think we should probably just leave it there. Marcus, you're a big guy too.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, have a very good weekend. Nice to see you.
You as well.
You too. Bye-bye.
Today's program was indeed produced by Marcus Hippy. He can actually be behind a microphone. He can be behind glass. And he can also host the menu, which we'll be hearing from in about 35 seconds time. A minute and 35 seconds time here on Monocle 24. Today's program was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Chris Fitch. And also Hannah Jenkins was also involved as a producer today as well. Up next, after the news, it is indeed the menu with Marcus Hippy. And as he said, we're going to be talking about all those things that are coming out in lovely bottles out of the Livermore Valley. And at 2200 tonight, of course, we have the Monocle Daily, which is our wrap-up of all events across the day. And tomorrow at 10 o'clock London time, it's the first issue of The Stack. Goodbye for now.